This is West Virginia Talks, a series of panel discussions presented at colleges and universities across the state. Today, we're at the West Virginia University Purley Isaac Reed School of Journalism in Morgantown for a discussion called From Beats to Tweets, Media Coverage of the Elk River Spill. The moderator is Emily Corio, a former reporter for West Virginia Public Broadcasting, now a teaching professor at the School of Journalism.
Hello, I'm Emily Corio, and I'm the moderator for tonight's discussion on the chemical spill and the ensuing water crisis. And I'd like to begin by introducing you all to our guest panelists this evening. And we'll start right here to my left with Ashton Mara. She is the State House reporter for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Next, we have David Boucher, who covers the state legislature also, but for the Charleston Daily Mail. April Call is a news anchor for West Virginia Media and is based at WOWK in Charleston. David Gutman is a reporter at the Charleston Gazette. Roger May is a documentary photographer who covered the chemical spill's aftermath for The Guardian. Eric Wagoner is a professor at West Virginia Wesleyan College and a blogger who wrote about the chemical spill on his website. Thank you all for being here. Many of these panelists here tonight have been with this story since day one. So that's where I'd like to begin tonight, with each panelist taking a couple of minutes to tell us exactly how you learned about the chemical spill and what was your initial reaction. And we'll start here with Ashton.
So at the time of the chemical leak, we were 4 days into the legislative session, I believe, 4 days. And at that time of the year, that is what I do. That is what I am completely focused on. So the first thing I had seen about this was on Twitter. Another reporter, and somebody from one of the Charleston newspapers had tweeted something about a press conference announcing that there was an issue with the water, and that was the first I had heard of anything. I'd been in the State House that day, so.
I was at the legislature as well, covering a story about legislation that would allow people to sue the government, you know, a really exciting bit to cover. And I also noticed on Twitter, some of the TV stations had been reporting some smells that people had been complaining about. Then about 2:30, the local emergency management service tweeted out a public notice saying that there had been a report and that it shouldn't be a big deal, but if you feel nauseous, go inside. I thought that was kind of an odd thing. And then at about 5:30, 6 o'clock, you started seeing a lot of indication from the water company and from the government saying that, you know, there's going to be a ban for 300, I guess they didn't know the number at the time, but a significant portion of the area to stop using their water. I wasn't on the story initially, but I tried to make some calls about from the government side and help out from the newsroom as well.
Thank you, David Boucher. April Call, can you respond?
I was live on the air. The tweet from Governor Tomlin came out at 5:36 p.m., and our statewide newscast begins at 5:30. So we were in the middle of what we call our A block, and I was in the studio, and I follow the governor's Twitter feed, and I always have my cell phone with me, always, always, always. And we were in what we call a soundbite, and I really quickly did a refresh on my Twitter feed, and I noticed the governor's tweet, which said, "Emergency, do not," in all capital letters, "use tap water for drinking, cooking, washing, or bathing in Boone, Lincoln, Kanawha, Jackson, Putnam counties, 5:36 p.m., January 9th. Then the soundbite ended, and I had to keep going on with live television news. So at that moment, I thought to myself, this isn't good. What can we do about it? So in the next commercial break, which came up within 3 minutes, I was actually moving to another part of our set, which is part of our normal format for our newscast. And as I ran out into our newsroom, I said, "Hey, did you guys see this? What do we know about it? I need to be able to say something in the next 5 minutes that we can confirm. Let me know what you got." And the next thing that happened to be coming up was what we call our main weather segment. And so while Spencer Adkins was talking about weather, everyone in our newsroom was getting on the telephone, trying to figure out who they knew, who might know something. The first phone call was to Amy Schuller Goodwin at the governor's office. Explain exactly what this means, why you sent it out, and give us a little bit of context. so that we can help people understand what's going on, because as you can understand, that isn't the sort of tweet that you see all the time. And that was sort of the way it began. As soon as Spencer was finished with Maine weather, he and I were standing next to one another, and I said, Spencer, we have some breaking news we need to pass along to our viewers. We're still working to get some additional information, but here's what I can tell you right now. And I read the governor's tweet verbatim, and I said, you know, we're gonna let you know as we get more information about this, but I think it's safe to say that this is not gonna be something that's short term. And I didn't realize then just how true that would be.
Thank you, April. David Gutman?
Yeah, I was sitting in the newsroom that morning, as I always do, and we had an editor actually came in, and mid that morning, I'd say 10 o'clock or so, said, hey, I smelled licorice on the drive-in, and he told another reporter, see what you can find out about this, and she found out some stuff, and I think, you know, early that afternoon, maybe 1 o'clock or so, we had, you know, a four-sentence story up saying, there's a licorice odor. We eventually got a little bit more. We found out, you know, there was a chemical leak. We got statements from the Department of Environmental Protection saying, yeah, there was a chemical leak. Don't worry about it. It's okay. We got a statement from the water company saying, this poses no threat to the public. Our systems are on top of it. And I got up and walked over to the water fountain. I think it was probably about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and took a sip, and it tasted like Robitussin, and it was oily and weird. And I went back to my desk, and I tweeted at the spokeswoman for West Virginia American Water, and I said, hey, Laura Jordan, the water fountain in the Gazette tastes like Robitussin. Are we sure this is okay? And, you know, an hour and a half later or so, we heard word from a spokesman for the Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety, who was actually a former Gazette reporter, and said, hey, in 5 minutes, the governor's telling everyone not to use the water. And so we tweeted that and put it breaking news on the website and went from there.
David Boucher, you weren't covering this story, but your attention quickly shifted, and I know that you did begin to cover this story. So what did you do in those initial first steps to begin your reporting?
Yeah, I actually, I called the newsroom when I saw it. I probably bug them too often. I was in the basement of the Capitol where the press room is, and I called them and said, did you guys see this? Do you need anything? And we had our nighttime reporter was going to the press conference, and we had a couple other people trying to work it from the newsroom, but I couldn't just go home. I don't know, so I drove into the newsroom and from the Capitol and started making some calls and got through to a couple of spokespeople and was able to learn a little bit more information, just like everybody else, through repetitively calling some of the spokespeople for some of the government agencies that were involved. And from there, after that first night, I think everybody, you know, had to report that story late to the night and started again really early next day, a Friday, and just continued going from there. With various success, getting all the of various people.
Does anyone else have a struggle that you faced in those initial hours of trying to sort out the information for this story, Ashton?
West Virginia Public Broadcasting right now is going through a big shift where we are trying to become more up to date, and we're really trying to incorporate social media, and recently just got a brand new website designed by NPR. And this was our first test in using new technology and making it work for us. A lot of you don't know much about public broadcasting, but we want that to change because you guys are getting your news from Twitter before you're getting it anywhere else, and we're starting to recognize that. So for us in those initial moments was, I need to report this. But it wasn't, this is gonna play at 7:30 tomorrow morning when we go to news. This is, I need to get it on Twitter right now, as soon as I know something. And that's a new way of thinking for our agency, but something that we're really working on.
Mm-hmm. I know that getting the facts straight for this story in particular proved to be challenging at times. For example, the amount of the chemical that was spilled changed. It started, I believe, at 2,500 gallons, and then went to 7,500 gallons, and I think we've stayed at about 10,000 gallons of the chemical that actually spilled. And then what exactly spilled also changed as this story progressed. So this can definitely make it challenging to cover as a reporter. David Gutman, how did you get the facts that you needed for this story?
I called people. I called them a lot. Going back to the first night, once that first don't use the water order went out, it was sort of, you know, everybody in the newsroom is on this story, and I didn't really have something I was assigned to do, and I was kind of antsy, and I'm like, I need to be doing something here. And so I think it was like 7 or 8 at night, and I drove down to the Capitol, and I was like, maybe there's something going on here, and there was absolutely nothing going on. And so I just went into the governor's reception room and sat down, and the receptionist was like, can I help you? And I'm like, well, I'm just trying to see what's going on. She's like, I don't think anyone's really coming out to talk to the press. And I go, well, I got nowhere else to be. And 10 minutes later, Governor Tomlin walked out, and I, you know, popped up and said, hey, Governor, can I talk to you for a minute? And talked for 10 minutes or so and called back to the newsroom and sent them some information. And I guess, you know, moving forward, it certainly was a challenge sometimes getting people to respond to you. I think in that first opening day and a half or so, what I was most frustrated about was that Freedom Industries was this company that spilled the chemical, and they were totally silent. I remember that Thursday night, I was just so mad. I couldn't sleep, and I woke up at like 5 o'clock, and I had all the previous evening, I'd been calling the president of Freedom Industries' home number, and no answer. And I drove out to his house and sat in the car. I'm like, you can't knock on somebody's door at 5 o'clock. What are you doing? And I sat in the car and listened to ESPN radio for like an hour and a half until it was 7 o'clock. I'm like, okay, now I guess now you can. He wasn't there, so that was all for naught. But I was still mad, and so then I drove down to Freedom Industries and knocked on the front door, and there was a secretary there, and I said, hey, is there anyone to talk? And she said no. And I just kind of started wandering around the facility, and I took some pictures and tweeted them. I'm like, this is what Freedom Industries looks like. And then she asked me to leave, and I did. And then I kind of walked around some more outside their fence line and took some pictures and tweeted them. I'm like, hey, this is what Freedom Industries looked like. And I'm not, you know, those tweets got retweeted a lot, so I guess people were interested. I'm not sure how much that added to anyone's real understanding, although going back in time, you know, I had pictures of the tank, and I had pictures of the river outside with one tiny little boom in the water, and where are the booms? Personally, that helped me a lot, because as I said the previous night, I wasn't really on the story, and then I, you know, tramped out over to Freedom Industries and took a bunch of pictures, and my editor was like, hey, you should stay on this story. I was like, hey, great.
But I do think, in talking to you beforehand, I know that your persistence also paid off with another angle of this story, which was the CDC, and I know several of you covered when there was a press conference where the CDC said that everything should be okay for people to use the water, and someone said, well, is it safe? And they said, well, we wouldn't call it safe.
Yeah, well, that's actually, I think, getting a little ahead of it. What initially happened, you know, they had the spill on Thursday, and by Friday, or by even Thursday evening, I can't remember exactly, the CDC had this, what we knew initially was nobody knows anything about this chemical. And then, you know, very quickly after that, the CDC had come up with this standard of one part per million is okay in the water. If it's below one part per million, you're fine. And I was like, well, that's awfully convenient. It's a nice round number. It's very easy to remember. It's a good thing it wasn't 1.24 parts per million, or 0.79 parts per million was the safe number. And so a colleague of mine, Ken Ward, you know, was on the phone to the CDC immediately after that on Friday saying, hey, where'd this number come from? And he didn't get anything. And then I work on weekends, so Sunday I called them and didn't get anything. They don't answer the phone. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I called them twice a day and spoke to a couple press people who were like, don't worry, we're marking your request urgent. We're going to get you someone to speak with immediately. And we got nothing. And then by Wednesday, I was leaving sarcastic messages on the machine. I'm like, hey, this is David. I've called several times. We want to know what, you know. And by this time, they had opened up. They had said the water's okay to use in a couple zones, and we still hadn't heard where this number came from that they were using. And I was like, look, I don't mean to harass you, but people are drinking the water now. People are showering in the water. We'd like to know, you know, how you know it's safe. Thanks for marking my request urgent, and then hung up. And then that Wednesday evening was at like 8 o'clock. I remember I was lying on the couch watching SportsCenter and scrolling through Twitter on my phone, and I think I saw some tweets from Dave Boucher about the CDC had sent an advisory about pregnant women, and the CDC said, hey, oh, check that. Still one part per million, but an abundance of caution, pregnant women might want to look to find another source, or the state might want to provide another source of water for pregnant women. And this is another, I was mad again, I was really mad. I couldn't stop pacing. I sent out a couple really angry tweets. I didn't know what to do. I don't know if I've ever been that mad. And I just looked up, went to White Pages on my phone and typed in the director of the CDC's name, which I didn't know, except he had signed that letter that they had just sent out. And I got his number in Atlanta, and I called him up. And I got his wife at first, and she's like, who is this? I said, this is David Gutman. And she said, where are you calling from? I said, Charleston, West Virginia. And then I got the director of the CDC on the phone, and I, you know, told him who I was, and I was from the Gazette. And he said, you need to go through the press office. This is a private number. And I was like, wait. He's like, no, you need to go through the press office. And he hung up. And then I called back to the newsroom where they were frantically updating the story to, you know, put on the front page, pregnant, don't drink the water. And I was like, would you guys like a quote from the CDC director? And they said, yes, very much so. And so we put that in the paper. They said, this is a private number. You have to go through the press office. And 10 minutes after I called the CDC director, the CDC called back and was like, we'll get you somebody to talk to. This is great. And I'm like, oh, great. I've been trying for a while. And he's like, okay, you know, let me just track down a scientist. I'll get you someone in half an hour. And I'm like, okay. And he called back half an hour later. He's like, I couldn't get you a scientist tonight. And I'm like, okay. He's like, how's first thing tomorrow? I'm like, that's great. And he goes, but can I ask you a favor? I'm like, you're not going to put that, you know, about calling the director in the paper. And I'm like, well, we probably are. And we had a little give and take there, and we put it in the paper. And they called back first thing next morning with a scientist and explained as best they could for 20 minutes. And I think later in the day, we had a bunch of reporters had a conference call, and the CDC was more receptive after that.
I'd like to switch gears now from talking about traditional reporting techniques to a relatively new reporting tool, and that's social media. I want to begin with Roger May. As I told you earlier, Roger was asked by The Guardian to cover the chemical spill's aftermath through photographs. And Roger, you then asked The Guardian if you could take over its Instagram account. Why did you want to do that, and how did it go?
Yeah, it was... It was really interesting. The first, they asked that you post a self-portrait to sort of introduce yourself as the quote-unquote storyteller for the assignment. And I did that as soon as I came out of the East River Mountain Tunnel there. Welcome to West Virginia. I pulled off on the side of the road and got the sign in the picture. And the very next image I think that I posted was standing in front of the Capitol on a Saturday morning in relatively quiet, snow-covered area. And I made a picture of the Capitol, and then I thought, well, Freedom Ministries, let me see the proximity of Freedom Ministries from here. And so I mapped it out, and 3 miles away from the Capitol. And for me, that was a lead into using those two locations as a visual thread to connect a story, to tell people on the other side of the world, this isn't just some holler in southern West Virginia or anywhere else. This is 3 miles from the state capitol.
Eric, I want to bring you into this conversation because your piece, your blog piece, received quite a bit of attention once you posted that. And perhaps some people in the audience here haven't read it themselves, so would you be willing to share just a little bit of it with us?
I happen to have a copy here with me.
Okay, so great.
Yes, oddly. This is, I blush to tell you, this is, I mean, you can hear what level of professionalism is up here on the panel, and there's no reason for me not to be forthcoming with you. As opposed to all the people up here who are actually doing gut work, I sat on the couch in my bathrobe about a pot and a half of coffee in and got up a good mat on and wrote this thing in like 90 minutes and posted it. So if you've read the piece, you know, my method of extempore expression tends to the profane. So we'll just sort of leap into it here. After telling the story about going down to Charleston 2 days after the spill to bring my parents and my sister and her husband and baby 10 cases of bottled water, I talk about coming in where 79 South meets 64, and 64 unrolls in this big kind of left-hand curve, and West Virginia American Water Company is right there on the left-hand side as you come into town. So over here is the water company. Out that direction is the Capitol and, you know, the hospitals and apartment buildings, banks, all that kind of stuff. That's an area that I know really well. I grew up there. I mean, I've driven that route hundreds and hundreds of times. And in the piece, I said this was the moment when I looked down and the smell, it was like that. I mean, when I came around a corner, I smelled it immediately coming in through the car vents. It hadn't been there, and then all of a sudden there it was. And I saw the water company, and I write about this like immediate rage that hit, and this is what I thought. To hell with you. To hell with every greedhead operator who flocked here throughout history because you wanted what we had, but wanted us to go underground and get it for you. To hell with you for offering above average wages in a place filled with workers who'd never had a decent shot at employment or education, and then treating the people you found here like just another material resource, suitable for exploiting and using up and discarding when they'd outlived their usefulness. To hell with you for rigging the game so that those wages were paid in currency that was worthless everywhere but at the company store, so that all you did was let the workers hold it for a while before they went into debt they couldn't get out of. To hell with you all for continuing as coal became chemical to exploit the lax, poorly enforced safety regulations here so that you could do your business in the cheapest manner possible by shortcutting the health and quality of life not only of your workers, but of everybody who lives here. To hell with every operator who ever referred to West Virginians as our neighbors. To hell with every single screw job elected official and politico under whose watch it all went on, who helped write those lax regulations and then turned away when even those weren't followed. To hell with you all who were supposed to be stewards of the public interest and who sold us out for money, for political power. To hell with every one of you who decided that making life convenient for business meant making life dangerous for us. To hell with you for making us the eggs you had to break in order to make breakfast. And much, much more in the same vein. There's a lot to that. But I posted this thing, and it was like a lot of people who have blogs, I don't post to it very often. I'm on social media as much as any 43-year-old man with a job, right? So I don't get on all that often. I think of my blog as kind of an open letter to me and people that I know that I hope is just kind of entertaining, or if there's like a funny personal story I want to tell, or something that I think will be of interest. So literally, this is no false modesty, honest to God. I thought maybe like, you know, 50 or 60 of my friends would look at it. I posted the piece to the blog. I put a link to the piece on my Facebook page. And then I went away to like wash dishes or do something. And I came back a couple hours later, and I noticed it on my Facebook feed that, you know, the way you put a link in and the thumbnail photograph comes up, the banner at the top of my blog, like the far left-hand side of the banner is my face and there are a couple of other pictures. And I started noticing that my face, which was cut off in this weird way, like I was looking around a door, like on the thing, started popping up in my Facebook feed like a slot machine. It just kept, people were sharing and sharing and resharing. And within 48 hours, that blog post on that page had gotten like 10,000 hits just from people passing it around. Within the next day, Huffington Post had emailed me and asked about reprinting it, which they did with some editorial stuff that was cleared with me and vetted. And after Huffington Post picked it up, then that's when it sort of took off. It got to Huffington Post. They retitled it, which was kind of unexpected, but like there it was. But through Huffington Post, I got an email from a producer at CNN Newsroom with Brooke Baldwin, who said they clearly lost their minds and wanted to get a foul-mouthed literature professor on for 5 minutes in the afternoon. So it was legitimately surreal. Like I said, I make no pretension to what that piece was about, which was just a rant. I mean, it was a straight shot. I'm egotistical enough to think the piece is, you know, written okay enough and that it does what it does tolerably well. But do not for a moment mistake this for any kind of actual boots on the ground journalism. It was, when I started getting, you know, people would get in contact with me from news agencies, I would immediately redirect to the Gazette and the Daily Mail and some of the journalists that I knew who were actually like following the story on and on and on. And so when it became apparent that it was going to be a thing, you know, for whatever it was worth, my biggest hope was that for as long as it was live and in the world, that it would continue the conversation in, like, on a national level, people would share and whatnot, for long enough that the story would get traction, that for whatever help it could be in that regard, that's what it would do. And I got emails, I mean, literally from all over the world. Within the first few days, I got emails from Denmark, India, Ireland. I found out the guy who draws Homer Simpson on The Simpsons linked to it on his Facebook page. And at that point, I was like, I win the internet, I'm done. That's it, that's all, you know. But like people, and I got emails from chemical engineers and from folks, the director of the public policy program at Harvard. I mean, it was weird. Like people who had absolutely no reason to get in touch with me other than this piece. And it was really interesting, I thought, like the confluence of the way in which the media, the news media, like just traditional news media, which is now also social media, kept really staying after the story and getting new information out and whatnot. So it was like this multi-pronged approach where journalists would get a hold of it and pass it around and it would get referenced in editorials. And so it became this weird sort of feedback effect. It was completely unexpected, but I'm really grateful that it happened.
You're listening to West Virginia Talks on West Virginia Public Radio, presenting a panel discussion about media coverage of the Elk River chemical spill in January. This event was recorded on Monday, March 24th at West Virginia University in Morgantown.
And to the other panelists, how did you use social media for sourcing information and for getting information out to your audiences?
I know for us at the Daily Mail, the leak happened on on a Thursday. And the Gazette and Daily Mail have an interesting relationship where the Gazette pretty much does the work for the weekend paper, and so the Daily Mail tends to report on Friday for Monday. So once breaking news like this happens, or this event happened, some of us in the newsroom, the newsroom at large, decided that it was worthwhile to continue to publish these stories online and to update as quickly as possible online, regardless whether or not it was going to be in the print paper on Monday. So that was kind of a shift for us. And I know that we also, used other forms of social media, in Twitter and Facebook and a couple other. We made a video with Elaine of Hall of Fame, which also I think helped out bring more traffic to our website for that. So that was initially that was our big push online.
April Call here. I can tell you for us, we as a company, but at WWK in particular, have been undergoing a recent, really big push in terms of social media. And this was a game changer for us. And I say that because we were exchanging a lot of information with our contacts. You've heard us mention Laura Jordan at West Virginia American Water, the governor's office, health departments, other water companies. And so it really did start an online conversation through social media, probably Twitter in terms of sourcing, but for us, Facebook became a real way to disseminate information to viewers. Because no matter where they were, what time of the day it was, they could get that information. And we started to really see tremendous interaction between our viewers on Facebook and information, photos, tips. And then that would give us the nugget of information that we could then use to take to our contacts at various agencies to try to get some information. And what we began to notice was television was extremely important from the standpoint of giving people constant information. And that sounds a little odd in that normally television news isn't constant. But the return of the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week crawl came back. Every television station in the market was doing, the ESPN crawl with whatever the latest information was. But all of that same information and a lot more was what we were able to continuously feed our Facebook and our Twitter feed. And we saw just at WOWK alone, prior to January 9th, and these are rough figures, but we had around 50,000 Facebook followers at WOWK, roughly. I checked today and we're at more than 92,000. And that almost doubling of our Facebook following occurred in very large part because of the water crisis. Now, that's not to diminish the fact we also had a number of weather crises which occurred during the same time frame. But if you couple the water and the weather, and in our newsroom over the past 2.5 months, we have a saying, what are we covering today? Weather and water, water and weather. That's it. Those are the only two things we're covering. Those two things combined really did change the game in our news operation when it comes to social media, and the way not only that we could utilize it, but the way we could interact with our viewers and have that conversation with them 24/7.
If I can just add, this is Ashton. I think that during this water crisis was the first time that I felt my professional social media became interactive. A lot of times as a reporter, you feel like your Twitter account is very one-sided, and I'm working on this story, and it's great, and I'm gonna put the information out there, and nobody responds. And that's hard sometimes. But I decided to take on the role of live tweeting all of these press conferences. And that kind of became the way for us to get information compiled quickly and onto the web as fast as possible. But at the same time, I started noticing, especially after the second press conference and also into the public hearings that they ended up having at the legislature, I'm live tweeting these things. And people are not just retweeting or favoriting these things, but responding to me and saying, well, can you ask them about this? Or nobody's answering this question, can you get an answer? And that was the first time that social media became a direct link for me into our audience, which I thought was a great thing and I hope can continue.
Mm-hmm. Those are great examples of how you all use social media well and how it aided you in your reporting. But what are some of the pitfalls that we as journalists have to be mindful of when it comes to using social media for sourcing and using social media to communicate with our audiences?
I think Twitter, for me at least, is really good for getting information out there, especially little tidbits that people are interested in, but you know, you can't write as a whole story. For instance, every day I would call the Department of Health and Human Resources to get their newest numbers on how many people have gone to the hospital. And those are really interesting numbers, and I think stuff people really want to know, but you can't lead an article you can include that every day, but you can't lead an article every day with, this is how many people went to the hospital today. But every day I'd send out a tweet saying, newest numbers on from DHHR, 200 people to the hospital, 15 hospitalized, 900 calls to the poison control center, and those got retweeted like crazy. And I think especially it's also helpful, you know, because you can look back a week later and kind of real easily just by looking at my own timeline track, you know, what went on here, and you can like, hey, look, they declared the water was okay to use on January 14th or whenever. And then 3 days later, we had this crazy spike in how many people went to the hospital. What's going on there? And I forget the original question.
The sources.
The pitfalls. Yeah, you know, you can waste, for me, the biggest pitfall on social media is I waste way too much time on it. I'm on it constantly, and it's way too easy to hit tweet.
Thank you, David Gutman. David Boucher, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I think it can be hard sometimes to verify the information you receive through social media. I mean, I think I was sent reports of data and testing that looked interesting, and I didn't have the capacity to fact check it in the, you know, 10 minutes that I was able to read through a report. Or you receive photos of water that's you know, green or red. You have no idea if this is what it's coming from. I feel like in the beginning there were videos going around about people lighting the water on fire, and that was something that people were hearing about, and that was a video that was spreading around, and the state came out and said, no, that can't happen, and it turned out that this video was from something else or it had nothing to do with it, the chemical in general. And so that's, as Dave said, there's always a temptation, at least for me, and I think other people too, you have this information, it seems like a good nugget that you should get it out there as soon as possible, but even, you know, from the state, I know we've received conflicting information numerous times from the state, and you put out, for example, that the site hadn't been inspected since 1991, and that was picked up by everybody, and everybody reported it a ton of times, and then we find out a week later that there have been all sorts of inspectors at the site for 20 years, and it was just the DEP, it took a little longer to find the information. And while, you know, obviously you can't control information you receive, I think social media allows us to get that information out much faster and on a wider scale. And regardless of whether or not you did something wrong or somebody else did something wrong, it can make for errors, you know, going out on a to many more people.
You touched on something that I wanted to ask about, and that's how social media was also used by agencies to get information out. And I wondered how you all felt about that, about that strategy.
I know, April Call, I know for our newsroom, our news operation, I found it very helpful just from the standpoint of we were in contact constantly with so many various agencies. I mean, we had 9 counties involved. You had local, county, state, federal agencies. So you had multiple levels of agencies that you were trying to get information from and have a conversation with about a multitude of issues. Because remember, initially this was a chemical leak. The chemical leak very quickly turned into a water crisis. Then you had 2 stories that were paralleling one another, but technically weren't the same story. So you were trying to cover the chemical leak and all of the associated water crisis angles that resulted from it, but they sometimes overlapped, they sometimes did not. So if you had, you know, if we were trying to find out information from Jennifer Sayre, for instance, in Kanawha County about whether they were going to have water tankers available at the Elkview location tomorrow, it was sometimes really nice to know, okay, Jennifer Sayre every afternoon at 4:30 is sending out an update on where the tankers are going to be tomorrow morning, because it was one thing that we could verify with her once that came out, and it was something that helped us along the way because we had so many other, you know, things that we were trying to accomplish.
Sorry, really quickly with that, Dave Boucher, I didn't like it, and for a couple reasons. One, I found it a little bit frustrating that sometimes an entity would tweet something out and then expect you to see that tweet when obviously your feed might have, you know, a ton of different things going on. And two, it lets agencies control their message more. And it lets the agency go right to the person, which obviously that's what they want to do. But, you know, I think that we're here to question that message and say whether that message is right or whether they're giving us accurate information. And so that's why I think there was a stretch for 10 or 14 days where we didn't have a press conference from the governor. And the first one we had came when he declared, I think it was February, declared February ski and snowboard month. And that was the first time we got to ask him questions in person, as opposed to seeing a Facebook post from somebody or seeing a tweet or something like that. And there's no way that you can get context on the information they provide if all they do is provide it via Twitter or via Facebook. So at times, and I mean, I did appreciate, you know, that information came out, but it's you need to be able to use that information in an effective way, and I didn't think that was, in my opinion, the best way for news media to effectively use it.
If I can break in, Eric Wagoner, I would say, too, that for the companies who are trying to use that, I mean, you can see why, as David said, you can certainly see why. But that is, I mean, in this case, that was a shaky strategy at best. I mean, what information were we getting in any kind of timely fashion? And I will tell you, looking at the feed, and you guys know this from following along, you know, when West Virginia, right or wrong, when West Virginia American Water Company, when some of these other companies would send out a tweet, would put out a Facebook post, whatever, the immediate response from a lot of people was, sure, right, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that, as David points out, you know, the sort of control of the narrative, and that's what social media is. It's a tiny piecemeal narrative, point by point, but it is a narrative, and it's supposed to unfold over time. But in addition to the problems with controlling that narrative, I think that also, to your last question, allows for an opportunity for bad information to get out via social media. I'd see, a couple of times this happened, I'd see a post from the water company that would be followed by, somebody would share it, and then in a comment say, oh, look what the water company says, but here we're getting this other report of a brand new chemical being found in the water. I said, what the hell, I haven't heard about this. I'd click on that link, and it would go to some whack job website whose two other headlines were about pillars of fire appearing over Columbus, Ohio, and secret numerology cults in the Vatican. I mean, it was just remarkable, the amount of misinformation that's coming out. So on the one hand, it's the sort of like severe control of the narrative, but I think it also kind of, in a situation where people already don't trust a lot of what they're hearing through these sort of administrative channels, it affords a circumstance where you really have to be careful about the kind of information that's being passed around person to person. Because on social media, if individuals who post don't vet, you know, as Dave says, it's out in the world now. Well, you can't call it back. It's like toothpaste back in the tube. You can't do it.
I think this is kind of a little anecdote that ties together, like, people, you know, the government trying to get out their message, and also the hazards of tweeting haphazardly. I think somewhere in that 10 to 14 day lull, when there was no, you know, there were a bunch of tweets and a bunch of posts, and but no, we never saw the governor. I think it was a Saturday night, because I work on weekends, and the governor's office sent out a transcript of what they called a community conference call. And it, you know, it had all these questions about, you know, why are people going to the hospital? And, you know, a lot of questions which, you know, if the governor was available for a press conference would have been asked. But it was just this transcript, and it didn't say who was asking the questions, and it didn't say, it said that they were being answered by three people, but it didn't say who was answering which question. And so I just fired back an email. I'm like, this is weird. When did this call happen? How come nobody was told it was going to happen? Who's answering these questions? And I got back pretty quickly, you know, from time to time the governor holds community conference calls to tell community leaders about things. And I was like, well, that didn't answer any questions I asked. And I think compounding this was what was in this community conference call, which was, you know, one of the questions was like, why are so many people going to the hospital? And the answer was, well, perhaps they're going to the hospital because it's flu season, or because there's a lot of anxiety going around, or because they haven't been able to wash their hands. All possibilities, but also, you know, there's a massive water contamination, and we don't know what's going on with this chemical, and, you know, we think it might be causing health problems, so we probably shouldn't dismiss everything. And so I emailed back, getting back to it, and I was like, wait, that didn't really answer my questions. Who was on this call? Why didn't we know? You know, who's answering these questions? Who is this transcript of? And like right about that time that I sent that email, I see the governor's Twitter account links a tweet or tweets out a link to this conference call. And I just responded, hey, @GovTomlin, who's answering these questions? When did this call happen? Was there really a call? Hindsight, I probably shouldn't have written, was there really a call? I got a call back like 10 minutes later from the governor's communications director, and she was furious. She was, she called my cell phone, and she was like, you know, nobody's ever done this. She was furious, and she's like, I'm just calling you as a courtesy to tell you I'm about to call your editors. And if she had, you know, given me a second, I would have been like, don't call the newsroom, I'm the only one here.
Just a moment. Hello.
But, she, you know, we hung up, and she called back the newsroom 5 minutes later, and I answered.
I'll look into it.
And she's like, there was some more yelling, and I didn't quite apologize. I half apologized. I never took the tweet down. I gave her the numbers for my home numbers for my editors. She called one of them, and anyways, you know, I probably should not have sent that tweet, you know, but it's really easy again to just hit send. But they, you know, on the other hand, probably, you know, should have let reporters ask questions because, you know, they can't, you know, stand in front of 300,000 people and be like, answer your questions, but they can, you know, answer some people's questions other than their own.
April Call here. I know we had a couple of instances And again, that lull, that period of time that Dave has mentioned and we've talked about a little bit, where there just wasn't any interactive communication happening, especially from the governor's office and from state agencies. But I remember they called what they called a briefing at the governor's office. It was late in the afternoon. It was like 4:30, 5 o'clock one afternoon. And they said, he's going to make a statement, but he's not going to take any questions. And I remember we had a serious conversation in our newsroom about whether we were going to go. Were we going to staff it? Because was it worth our time to go and listen to a prepared statement when we were being told we would not have an opportunity to pose any questions? And, you know, I was the acting news director at the time, and I said, oh, we're going to go, and we're going to ask questions. And if we don't get answers, we don't get answers. But if we're not there, we can't even ask. And so we went, and interestingly enough, he did take questions. And we got some answers. I don't think they were terribly helpful at the time, but we did at least have the opportunity at that point to have some dialogue, which at that point had been, you know, almost non-existent. So the theme I keep hearing through all of our questions and our responses up here is persistence, whether it's sitting and listening to the radio in your car for an hour and a half until, you know, it seems more appropriate to knock on someone's front door, or whether it's, you know, taking a phone call in the middle of the night in your newsroom, or whether it's sending somebody a tweet or sending an email 15 times or calling the same agency 4 or 5 times a day, threatening a lawsuit or you know, filing a FOIA request. If you're not persistent, and that's our job, then you won't get anywhere. And, you know, I've always told the reporters and the wannabe reporters in my classes through the years, you don't have to be rude, you don't have to be mean, but you do need to be politely persistent. And I think there were probably a few times during this process that the politely part got pushed aside a tiny bit out of necessity, but persistence.
So what are your takeaways from this in thinking about the roles of traditional reporting and social media? And Ashton, we'll start with you.
I guess what I took away from all of this is how important it is to know your sources. And I have always found, I haven't been doing this for long, but I have found that you need to know your sources in good times when there is nothing for them to tell you in order for them to tell you the things they need to tell you when things are bad. So what I took from this is that I need to build those sources. And I've done that as far as the State House side goes, but it was hard for me to go and talk to these emergency communications directors because I had never met them before, and why should I talk to this girl from public broadcasting who doesn't want to talk to me except for right now because there's something big going on. So it's important to build those relationships, and it's just as important to build them when there's nothing for them to tell you as it is when there's all this stuff going on.
Okay, thanks, Ashton. Dave Boucher?
Yeah. Don't be afraid to do some of your own research too. I think that you know, there's at least other experts outside of the state of West Virginia or other people that are a phone call away and ready to talk to you. Don't be afraid of documents. There's a ton of information in a document, and if you take 5 minutes to learn how to read it or ask somebody how to read it, you can get a ton of information from that. Last week we just got a new document that presented a new name of the chemical that might have been in the tank. And they can look intimidating, but it's just some of those things that once you get it and understand it, it's very easy to use and turn some of this numbers reporting into usable data. As April said, call lots of people and call more than once. You might not think that you're rude, but they might, and that's okay. But just the more that you call that person or the more that you contact that person, that's certainly going to help as well. And I also think that you never know when national media is going to pay attention and when they're not. But when they do, it's nice to try and take advantage of that and try and get out as much information or as, you know, any sort of vital information as you can, and hope that, you know, other people can pick up on that as well.
Thank you, Dave. April?
I'm going to go with the three P's: people, persistence, and a plan. Without the people and the relationships that you build over time in your community as a boots-on-the-ground reporter, when there's a crisis, you don't have the connections that you may need. And so, as Ashton mentioned, having those relationships, nurturing those relationships, no matter what time it is, whether you need them in that particular moment or whether you don't, that's key. People and the connections and relationships that you build. Persistence. Like Dave said, you're going to get no. You're going to get no response. And you're going to get it a lot. Especially if you want something from some agency or some person they don't really want you to have. And so you have to go back to the well over and over and over again. And yes, I just realized what I said. I do mean that specifically. Go back to the well over and over and over again. And then finally, have a plan. If your news organization doesn't already have a plan on how to deal with crises, now's the time to do it. Have a three-screen attack. How are you going to attack social media? How are you going to attack online? How are you going to attack your broadcast message? And how are you going to do it consistently? Because you can't do it just once or one day out of an event and be successful. What you do one time well, you have to be able to replicate. And that means you have to have the plan with your people in place in the strategic locations within your structure that will work best. Turn your newsroom into a war room and have the plan in place in advance so that you can just flip the switch and make that transition immediately. And you will find that it goes a lot smoother.
Thanks, April. David Gutman?
I think it's just really, it's important to work hard. That's obviously self-explanatory. I mean, not self, it's obvious, but you get better stories, you'll get, more information if you don't punch out the clock at 5:30, and if you stay around, and if, as Dave said, take the time to go through the documents yourself, and if you don't understand the documents, call somebody up. When Freedom Industry filed for bankruptcy, we were, doing our best to pour through the bankruptcy papers, and I just looked up a couple bankruptcy lawyers in the phone book and called them up, and I'm like, I don't understand this. What is this part here? Can you help me? And they're like, yeah, and it turned out, hey, it looks like Freedom Industries is creating a funding company and then another funding company so that they can lend money to themselves, and we got that in the paper the next day. And I don't know the first thing about bankruptcy, but, just take the time to read through the documents yourself, and if you don't understand something, call somebody up, Don't take them at face value, because, take things at face value and the 500 people went to the hospital because it was flu season. So work hard and don't be afraid to ask people for help. I don't know.
Thanks, David Gutman. Roger May, what do you come away with in terms of the roles of social media and traditional reporting?
Well, I think it reinforced for me the relatively short attention span of the national media. It's incredibly frustrating to have this story break nationally, and then Justin Bieber gets arrested, and then the Super Bowl happens, and meanwhile there are still 300,000 plus West Virginians who don't have access to clean drinking water. For those of you that are old enough to remember the Exxon Valdez spill and in Alaska, and what a catastrophe that was, you won't have any trouble at all researching news clips and media coverage of that disaster. But in the year 2000 in Martin County, Kentucky, there was a spill that was 30 times larger than that. And I'll bet you that you can find hardly a shred of evidence that that ever even happened. Because it didn't happen in Alaska, and because it didn't happen in New York, and because it didn't happen in California. And so I think we can't rely on the national media to cover events and to talk about important events that matter here locally. And every journalist at this table has just done an amazing job. So I would like to personally applaud your efforts in that. And to circle back around, to close that thought out is the power and the importance of a personal story to help your readers, your viewers, your audience to be able to identify with the issue on a human level. We're all human beings. We all crave and desire the same very basic things, clean water, clean air, those sorts of things. And if you can find a way to tell a personal story in your community rather than relying on the national media to do it, it's going to have a far more impact.
Thanks, Roger. Eric?
To pick up on Roger's point, here's the kind of brilliant teacher I am. I was telling a creative writing class about a week and a half before this all blew up that blogs were completely superfluous. Did not matter, made nothing happen in the world. And so, I don't know if you're looking for an English teacher at WVU, but when you invest in the kid, that's the kind of far-thinking insight you get. But in 99 times out of 100 cases, that is in fact probably true. But to go back to Roger's point, don't forget that people, journalism school, like, young folks like you who are going into the field, people are looking for somebody to get their story told. That can be the story that happens to 3,000 people over 9 counties, or it can be the story of one family. We access those two kinds of stories in very different ways. That's why these are two very significant prongs in this kind of, advocacy work, if you think about it that way. And there is nothing in the piece that I wrote, for example, that would not be true of any of the other 300,000 people who were there that this all happened to. That's just one story, but it's a story. The piece that I wrote had a face. It had characters. It had my family members. It was one person's voice. And the kind of emails that I got, I will tell you, that became impossible to keep up with, by and large, were people who said, the way that you wrote that, the things that you said, expressed something that I have felt a lot, that people I know that I've talked to have felt, but we've never seen said in this kind of public forum, and that nobody's ever phrased in quite this way. And people are hungry for that. And even in a media culture that is saturated with personal media, Twitter, Facebook, blogs, and so forth, when something like that happens, it's got to be the proper moment. But when something like that happens, it can have legs. And the reason it has legs is because people are looking for stories like that to be told. It's just as has been said. People want to access it that way. People want to understand that human face.
Please join me in thanking our panelists tonight, Ashton Mara, David Boucher, April Call, David Gutman, Roger May, and Eric Wagoner. I'm Emily Corio. Thank you to our audience here in the WVU Mountain Lair Ballrooms and to those listening on West Virginia Public Radio.
You've been listening to a panel discussion at West Virginia University in Morgantown called From Beats to Tweets, Media Coverage of the Elk River Spill. Our special thanks to Pearly Isaac Reed School of Journalism Dean Marianne Reed and moderator Emily Corio. This panel discussion was recorded by Beneduccio. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. For West Virginia Talks, I'm Beth Voorhees.